Hi, everybody. We have a Patreon that we call Maltreon. You can join us. We have $3, $5, $10, $20 options. You can get newsletters from my dad, all kinds of neat stuff behind the scenes. Hang out with us, learn about who our guests are before anybody else, and listen to the podcast before anybody else. Go to patreon.com/maltononmovies for more information.
That's patreon.com/maltononmovies.
Hi, everybody. I'm Leonard Maltin.
And I'm Jesse Maltin.
You're listening to Maltin on Movies. And speaking of movies, we're interviewing a man today who today is sending out future film directors and writers into the world, but has a resume as long as your arm of TV shows and movies that he's directed. You might have heard of Saturday Night Fever.
Never, no.
or War Games or Blue Thunder or Nick of Time or one of my favorites, the Bingo Long Traveling All-Stars and Motor Kings, which was his first theatrical feature. But he directed lots of television before that and has done television since. He is a director, and he's appropriately at the directing program at Chapman University here in Southern California. Hello to John Badham.
Hi there. Hi, everybody. Everybody who's listening to this, thanks for tuning in and stick with us. The good part's coming yet.
That's right. Well, we just said, so you just finished your 19th year teaching. My dad just completed 25 at USC. And for those who don't know, Chapman University is in Orange, California, which is south of Los Angeles. And it's an incredibly well-known school and has a fantastic film program.
Which has been growing
in
recent years and growing in stature as well.
Our friend Scott Feinberg has been lecturing there. And yeah, it's a really, I like it because it's smaller in the sense that for my friends who've gone, they felt like it was a more intimate experience because the film program is really tight-knit, and they love it.
Well, we're proud to say that Hollywood Reporter sees us as the number 4 film school in the country.
Yeah, I go with that.
This is from a few years ago when we were not even heard of.
Yeah. I know. I'd say it's wild. If you live here, if you live in California, you know the school well because people talk about it. But yeah, USC and Chapman have two really incredible film programs, and they're both schools are very lucky to have you guys, because hearing from someone, I've always hated the phrase "those who can't do teach," because it's really the extreme opposite. Those with that kind of knowledge are the best kind of teachers, because you're sharing from the experience you have and continue to have, you know?
Well, we're thrilled to do it, and it's exciting to be with the new perspectives of young filmmakers coming up and the new kind of ideas that maybe we would never have thought of, but it keeps our mind open and awake to continuing possibilities of storytelling.
Of course.
Yes, and I find I learn from my students. I'm sure you would agree with that.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I mean, 2 years ago, I wouldn't have considered Everything Everywhere All at Once. But, you know, now I've had to learn to learn to appreciate that kind of storytelling.
Yes, exactly. And one of the first important lessons I learned, lecturing to a large class, especially of mostly 20-somethings, is don't snow them. If you don't know the answer or something, say so.
Say you don't know the answer.
Don't try to get by. Don't try. They can smell fakery a mile
away. Especially since they all have laptops sitting in front of them and they can just Google.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. No, you can't fake it. Just go ahead and admit it.
Yeah.
It's all right.
Yeah, it's
you
all right.
Then they'll come and help you.
Exactly.
Well, you know, you've had such an interesting life and career, but your beginnings of moving around and living different places, and you were born in England, yes?
Yes, in Luton, which is about 100 miles north of London.
Yep.
And
there's an airport there.
Yeah, yeah. And I was lucky. My mother remarried at the end of World War II an American Air Force general who brought us to Alabama, of all places,
wow,
which is one of the great culture shocks of all time, going from war-torn England to Alabama.
Now,
how long were you in Alabama for?
Well, till I went to college.
Mm-hmm.
I went to Yale as an undergraduate and then to the Yale Drama School. And after that, I moved to California,
mm-hmm,
to see about this silly business called movies.
Right.
Now, why you and your sister both pursued acting? I don't know if pursued is quite the word, but you were both acting as children. Why didn't you stay with it?
Oh, well, I was never a very good actor. I loved doing it. It's great fun. But when friends of mine, like, say, Sam Waterston, you know, we're getting all the lead parts, and I'm getting the second spear holder from the left, you know, I thought maybe I should look into that thing where I see this guy walking down the hall of the drama school and all these girls following him. Who's that? That's the director. Yes, that's for me. I enjoyed doing that and working behind the backstage and then eventually behind the camera,
mm-hmm,
as something that was very satisfying for me to do. And my sister, actually, who starred in To Kill a Mockingbird with Gregory Peck.
No big deal. She was Scout in To Kill a Mockingbird.
No big deal.
Yeah.
Yeah. She was 9 years old at the time that I was like 22 or 23 in the drama school. And my mm-hmm mother calls me and says, "Your sister is in a movie with Gregory Peck. And she's 9 years old."
What have you done lately?
Yeah, and I'm on scholarship at the drama school, you know.
Cut
my wrists now. Right. Kill me now.
I'll tell you, I relate. The running joke in our family, especially with my dad's parents when they were still around, was my dad was publishing his fanzine and then got, you know, and then was able to publish a book by the time he was 18. So I was a failure by the time I was 12. I had nothing. There was no pressure because he'd already done everything. So there was no chance I was going to beat that. And it was good. It's good to know that you're going to be a failure early, you know?
Well, the one interesting note about my sister is she's been touring for the last year and a bit in the road company of To Kill a Mockingbird.
Really?
With Richard Thomas?
With Richard Thomas.
Oh, my.
Wow. And she's playing one of the grouchy old neighborhood ladies that was always harassing Scout.
Yeah.
Oh, my. Is she having a good time?
She says she just loved this gypsy life.
Huh. Yeah.
She's going from town to town to town every week. She just signed up. She just re-upped for another year.
Oh, my goodness. Well,
what an experience.
God bless her. That's great.
Yeah.
Now, you have so many interesting tidbits and observations and anecdotes in your book, but one that made me laugh was result directing. Now, I'm not an actor, but I appear on camera a fair amount, and I've been directed. I've been directed with phrases like more energy, lots more energy.
Or if I'm there, sit up straight. Yeah, that's the...
Yes, I know the sit up straight one myself.
Yeah, that's a big one.
Yeah. Result directing is something that's very hard to get over. We think we can give simple instructions of what we want, but what we wind up getting is something that's sort of cliched. The direction more energy just makes you kind of hop up and give you the cliched version of talking louder and faster, but that's not necessarily better. It's probably just kind of, how should I put it? What I need to do is I need to give you as the actor a verb and say, really convince these people that, mm-hmm, you know, educate them what you're talking about.
Yeah.
And instead of more energy, I get something where you're trying to explain something to a person if you're saying, you know, more energy. Or in this scene, you're about to miss your train. Keep that in mind in this in this whole conversation, that you're going to miss your train.
Yeah,
or, that's good solid direction. Those are keys that unlock a situation.
It gets your imagination to going. Mm-hmm. So instead of coming up with a cliche, you come up with your version of whatever catch a train is.
Yeah.
Or I have to go to the bathroom. Mm-hmm. Something like that. You'll get interesting ideas from that. So what we teach at Chapman and in a lot of places else too, because this idea is not original with us, is using active verbs to use to direct the actor, not just results of what you want, but translate that into some kind of active verb that relates to the situation that you're talking about, the scene you're talking about.
Well, your experience shows in just a few minutes talking to you. The name of John's book is I'll Be in My Trailer, the creative wars between directors and actors.
And it's got a great cover.
Co-written by Craig Moderno. And you've just done an audiobook version, brand new.
It's exciting to be able to put it out that way, because we did an audiobook version of my other book, which is called John Badham on Directing. Mm-hmm. And what we noticed in the time since then, that so many people listen to it in the car.
Yeah.
And come up and tell, I drive to work, I've got a long drive to the shoot, and I'm listening to you in the car. And I'm saying, well, we ought to do this with the other book, because so much of it is about how to treat actors with respect.
Mm-hmm.
And with young filmmaking students, that dealing with actors is very intimidating for them.
Yeah.
Deal with cameras, lights, microphones, technical CGI, all that stuff, they kind of like pick it up instantly. But dealing with human beings who have this annoying habit of having opinions,
right,
and their own ideas, that you can't just shut them down. You can't. You are a fool not to take advantage of their creativity and what they bring to the party.
Right.
And if they don't bring anything, which sometimes happens, well, of course you've got to be prepared. What do you do if nobody else has any good ideas?
Yeah.
But you have to treat your actors like your creative partners, not like slaves that are doing your bidding.
Yeah.
Right. And yet you still have to assert your authority.
Yes, you do. It's a tricky balance to find. So when people come to you with ideas, you never want to say, oh, that's terrible, it's the worst idea.
Right.
You want to say, well, that's really interesting, I never thought of it that way. Let me think of that. And you know, and surprise, surprise, very often it turns out to be a good idea. You just need to give it a little 30 seconds to bake in your mind, to microwave it, and then it comes out, you know, like that's a good idea. And if it's not, the person is still willing to come back to you tomorrow with another idea. You haven't shut them off.
Right.
You haven't shut out their creativity. You're wanting them to be part of everything. And so we don't believe in the old Otto Preminger, Henry Hathaway school of directing that is just dictatorial and mm-hmm. do it my way or go home.
Yeah.
But there's so many examples in your book of real brinkmanship where it's you versus him or her. And it seems like you're in the middle of production. The clock is ticking. Money is running by, flowing like a river. And somebody's got to win. Somebody's got to lose. How do you explain that situation to a novice?
Well, somehow you have to get the you have to acknowledge that the actor who is causing a problem has a problem, and that you can't shut that down. Just like with a little child who's running across the rug and falls down and skins their knee. The last thing you can say to that child is, oh, that doesn't hurt. That's okay. That's not a big deal. Because the child would just wail louder. Well, the same thing happens with the actor. No, that's no big deal. Just do it my way. What you have to say is, well, that sounds interesting. Tell me about that. You have to acknowledge that there's a problem there and listen so that the person at least is being heard.
Right.
And that's what I had to learn the hard way, because I think I would start out, you know, saying if there's a problem, just shut them off and take command. You're the director. But that's not a good thing. If you don't acknowledge they have a problem, you'll never get out of this hole. You'll always be stuck there. But to say, yes, tell me about that. Tell more. Explain more to me. So a story I tell in the book about running into a big argument with John Travolta on Saturday Night Fever. If I had had the good sense at that time to say, explain to me what the problem is, that we never would have been held up for 2 hours at the middle of the night in minus 30 degree temperature on the Verrazano Bridge. And it was not his fault. He had a problem, and I needed to acknowledge that.
What was the problem?
Well, we had shot with stunt doubles beforehand. There was a stunt involved where one of the John Travolta's buddies had fallen off the bridge, and I was pressed by production to shoot the stunt first because the bridge was going to get colder and icier in the middle of the night. So we did that first, and as it turned out, when I brought John out and I showed him what the stunt doubles had done, he said, I don't do that. I'm not going to stand like that. I'm going to be standing straight up. I'm not going to be down on my knees protecting myself from falling off this bridge 200 feet. I'm going to be stand up and try to be reassuring. And what I did was I started arguing with him about, well, we've done this already with the stunt guys and we can't do that over again. And he just kind of shut down and said, nope. So eventually I had to go in and apologize to him and say that we would do it his way. And it was left to me to figure out later how to make it match with
right. What
I had already, how to make it match with what I'd already shot, which we managed to do with no big problem. But I didn't need to have all that argument. If I had just taken the time, then we would have probably figured a way out of it. But instead, I irritated him so much that he walked off the set, and thus the title of this book, I'll Be in My Trailer.
I have a mental image of you face-to-face arguing with Richard Pryor on location for Bingo Long.
Yes.
I would not have wanted to be in your shoes.
Oh, no. And somebody so clever and so smart as Richard, and feeling that he had been abused because I didn't acknowledge that he was in a slightly dangerous situation where one automobile almost cracked into another. And yet it all ended quite safely, and it wasn't any more than just a kind of a breath hiccup. And I wrote it off as, well, I'm glad we're all right. I'm glad Billy Dee Williams and James Earl Jones are fine. Richard is fine too. In fact, he was the safest of all. But what he wanted was for me to come up and really apologize to him for putting him in what he thought was serious danger. And at that point I was thinking, well, I'm not going to bend over to this, the will of this guy who just wants me to be humble. I'm going to stand up to him.
Yeah.
And be a smart aleck, you know, because it was good for me in the eighth grade. Why not here as a grown up? you know, being a smart aleck here. And again, thanks to my partner, Rob Cohen, he managed to save the day and come in and sort of settle Richard down, came back and Rob came to me and said, you have to apologize to him, you know, for making him feel unsafe, which I did.
Yeah.
But as you say, just face to face with him was quite unnerving. But I was determined to be, you know, Mr. Stand-up guy, mm-hmm. which is a dumb thing to do.
You see, you learn, you know, if you don't have the experiences, you just don't know. And now you're doing something so incredibly valuable. Obviously, the book's been out, but, you know, you're doing something so valuable. And by teaching your students about this, you know, showing them how they can get the best result, even if it's not real, even if you don't really care what they have to say, learning how to, at the very least, make them feel included and make them feel heard and respected, you know?
This book came out of an interesting visit I made to the AFI, the American Film Institute, and I'm talking to their graduates in a general Q&A, and then one student, a woman, said to me, "I have a question for you. What do you do when actors don't do what you want them to do?" And I said, "Well, I don't know how long I have talk about this," but suddenly noticed, and my partner noticed too, that the entire room sat up and paid attention.
Mm.
Their laptops, they stopped doing talking on their phone, checking their emails,
yeah.
whatever they were doing, and they suddenly were paying attention. And we said, "There's a book here, because this is something that young filmmakers and grown-up filmmakers too need to know more about, to understand that you don't have to be a dictatorial mm-hmm. kind of person, that there's a good way to get them to understand the mind of an actor and a creative artist that you're getting to the pleasure of working with."
Yeah.
You, toward the end of the book, you have a very interesting chapter about being forced to work with an actor who was, you quickly realized, was an alcoholic. And no one wanted to say it out loud, and no one wanted to fire the actor. And you just had to deal with it, but you knew what was in store, ultimately.
Ultimately, it's interesting. I knew what was in store as we were lining up the very first shot of the very first day. I'm going, "Oh my Lord. Oh, the guy at 7:30 in the morning is already a little drunk."
Oi.
And I'm trying to encourage the network and the producers that we should cut our losses right now and hire whoever was number two on our list,
yeah,
or whatever we were going to do. But somehow they just felt, "No, we're going to make this work. It's going to be all right." And I literally, I guess the only choice I had would have been to resign from the picture, or try to be a good soldier and to see how I could make it work.
Yeah.
But I learned that doing more takes with this guy wasn't effective at all. He just got drunker.
Oi.
And the idea that we could fix this in post and editing and we'd be able to cut it out. It's hard to cut people slurring their words.
I imagine. Yeah.
And with the tempo of a snail, he was playing a journalist for, you know, an imaginary magazine like Time or Life or something like that. And journalists, as we know, are pretty sharp people and energetic and sharp and so on. And instead we were getting somebody who had probably been thrown out working for the Valley Green Sheet.
Yeah.
Well, that's a That's a bad reference to an old newspaper that's no longer published in the Valley that was free.
I think
where journalists went to die.
What kind of lessons did you learn when you started directing episodic TV?
Well, one of the big things in episodic TV is the leads. They know their character better than anybody.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, even if they don't know the right thing, they believe that they know it better than anybody.
Right.
So that you're trying to support them, but you're not going to go in there and tell them about their characters. They know that. And what you're trying to do is support what they're trying to do and what they want to do. Where you're the most effective is with your secondary guest stars and day players who are coming in. They don't know any of these other people. This is their first time. If it's a day player, the poor guy, you know, hasn't had a job in 3 months and is very, those are the people that need your support and direction as how to blend them into this particular show. No matter what it is, you've got to get them on the same wavelength as the rest of the show. They can't come in playing comedy in the middle of a drama or vice versa.
Mm-hmm.
like that. So you can be the most helpful that way. I learned that from George Bernard Shaw, who, when he was a drama critic in London, he said, the way I judge directors in plays is not by the performance of the leads, but by the performance of the secondary and tertiary characters.
Yeah. That's the thing. I mean, if you see, this is true. It's sort of like, you know, they find those funny, is it in North by Northwest where the kid covers his ears before a gunshot?
Yeah.
You know, there's those little moments that we find that are sort of just funny. You know, it's not the end of the world. It's funny, but it is something where, and you definitely do notice this on stage. If everyone's good, then they blend beautifully. If somebody is not, they stick out like a sore thumb and it's all you can see.
Oh, that's absolutely right.
You know?
Yes.
When you did 6 episodes of Night Gallery, which I watched faithfully way back when, did you have any contact with the other young Turks who were storming the castle there? Mr. Spielberg, Boris Segal, so many fledgling directors got their feet wet.
Oh, yes.
Shows like that.
Jeannot Schwartz.
Mm-hmm.
Jeannot and I did several, and Steven Spielberg did, well, he did the pilot.
Right.
And then I think he did one or two episodes after that. But Steven's career took off like a rocket.
Right.
And next thing you know, he's out doing features, and we're slaving in the vineyards trying to be good enough to get a break like he did.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Doing Night Gallery was such fun for all of us, because every week it was something different. It was different actors,
mm-hmm.
very totally different storylines, ghost stories and mystery stories from all over the world. So you never knew what you were going to get. And so I had a show with Ozzy and Harriet as the leads, and a show with Rene Aubergenois that was called Camera Obscura. That was one of the most fun things I ever got to do. These episodes they just encourage you to use your imagination to come up with crazy things that nobody would do in regular, ordinary television.
You've done now some recent episodic work, and for some of the streamers, and for ABC Family, and which is now Freeform.
Freeform, yes.
Which is probably something else by the time we're done with this podcast.
Right.
But So you've done episodes of Supernatural and Siren and Nikita and Rush Hour. And before that, Psych, which my wife was...
My mom's obsessed with, yeah.
Great yes. fan. Any difference between then and now other than faster?
Well, thank goodness. At least Universal was so penurious that they were doing our shows in 6 days. Mm. And nowadays, at least you get always seven, if not eight or nine. Mm-hmm. And that helps a lot. But of course, the shows are even way more ambitious than they were back in those days.
Right.
So you find there's more action scenes, more special effects, and all of that that have to be factored in. And you're still on a pretty tight schedule. But it's great fun because you can do a lot of work in a short amount of time. Come in, and in 3 weeks, you've prepared and done some interesting episode and been able to stretch your imagination, try things that maybe in a regular movie, if you got to do one every year or every couple of years, you didn't get to experiment with as many things as you could.
Yeah.
And working with actors, you can work pretty fast, and actors like to work fast. So in Supernatural or what's the other show I'm trying to think of, Heroes.
Sure.
I did a lot of episodes of Heroes. I mean, it's just great fun because they're so imaginative and fun to just say, well, let's just put ordinary physics and ordinary reality aside for the moment.
Yeah.
Let's just go with this. What would happen if?
Yeah.
And that's great fun.
Yeah. What was it like your first time directing a film? What was that like for you?
Wow. Well, first time directing a television show. I had the support of Hal Holbrook, who was the lead in the series called The Senator, and his partner Michael Tolan, who was another wonderful actor, and they were very supportive. So even though I was kind of terrified my first day on the set, I knew that these guys all had my back.
Sure.
And helped me through it. So
you lucked out there.
Oh gosh, I really did. What a treat for a first time director. Mm-hmm. to get to work with them. And I did two episodes of that show that won Hal the best dramatic actor of the year in Emmys, and it won the Emmy for the best dramatic show. So I was really privileged to be a part of that.
Sure.
And it started my career off with a bit of a bang.
Right.
Because now people would take me seriously, a little more seriously.
Mm-hmm. What was the biggest biggest evidence of transition from doing episodic to doing a feature-length film? Your first feature, theatrical feature, was Bingo Long.
Right. Well, I've been lucky in between. That would have been a huge jump to go straight from one to the other. Mm-hmm. But I've been lucky in between to do several movies of the week. Mm-hmm. that had much better schedules and was able to show people that I could do something in 24 or 25 days that if you went to a movie schedule of 38, 40, 50 days, you could probably handle that. Because it is a big change. You're trying to be much more exact in a movie. Your level of quality has got to be that much higher.
Right.
Whereas you could maybe slough over some weak points in an episodic, well, we'll fix that in post. You know, well, it's not the best performance, but we'll work around it. But here in a movie, you don't have that excuse. You can't say, you know, well, the actor wasn't so good. Well, who cast that actor?
Right.
And yeah, and who picked that camera move there? So stupid and arbitrary. So it did take a lot of adjustment. And I never forget standing on the set of one of my first movies where I showed the cameraman a setup and he looked at me and just kind of rolled his eyes and went, "Oh, so TV."
what an insult.
Knife right in the heart.
Yeah.
Oh, such a TV setup.
Oh, dear. And now on a lot of the high end television shows, they're really done almost like features.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, they are. They are. The schedules are wonderful, and they spend a lot of money, especially the streaming networks, and the poor regular standard old fashioned networks are struggling yeah. mightily as people cut the cord and are sticking with streaming.
Mm-hmm. Well, they've built a better mousetrap in a lot of ways. They've given people a reason to stay home, which is not good for the movie industry or the movie theater industry. But it's not dull what's going on right now.
No, it's exciting, and there's so many choices out there.
Yeah. There's so many things I could go over from your book. Would you tell the story about The Wiz? You had the opportunity to direct musical version of a black musical interpretation of The Wizard of Oz for Universal.
Yes. Well, when we were preparing Bingo Long, one of the things that I went to see a couple of times in New York was the musical The Wiz, and we cast two or three actors out of that who had actually won Tonys for their performances in The Wiz. When we were through with Bingo Long, I said to Rob Cohen, who was at that point a producer for Motown, I said, "You know, we should be producing The Wiz and directing it." One studio, I think 20th Century Fox, had bought the rights, but they decided they couldn't handle it. It was too much for them. So we persuaded Universal to buy the rights for it. And we would again be working with Berry Gordy, who was the head of Motown, and so on. So Rob and I were looking to adapt the script ourselves and figure out how best to bring it to the screen and what things should look like. So early on in the process, we get a call from Berry Gordy saying, "I understand Diana Ross has called me and she wants to play Dorothy." And I said, "Well, Diana Ross is a beautiful woman, a great singer, a wonderful actress, a wonderful dancer, but she's 30 years old. And Dorothy in the original books is 6 years old."
Yeah.
You know, it was already a stretch when they had Judy Garland playing her with her chest bound down and everything.
Yeah.
And so that doesn't sound right to me. We were hoping to go back to finding somebody that looked like they were closer to six, because so much of The Wizard of Oz is a child's fantasy about the Cowardly Lion and the Tin Man and the Wizard. All of this is from a child's point of view. And well, she kept calling Berry Gordy. He kept calling Ned Tannen, who was head of Universal. Mm-hmm. They kept calling me. And finally it got to the point where I didn't know what to do. And my father told me, he said, "Don't quit. Don't you dare quit, because they won't have to pay you. But if they fire you, they'll have to pay you."
Wow.
And you go, "Oh my God, what am I going to do? I don't have any better offers here." So I, in a meeting where it was all to be resolved in a room with the head of Universal and the head of Motown, I said, I know exactly what to do here. I understand how to make this work with Diana Ross in a movie that that was done years ago, the lead actor was never seen, just only the reflection in the mirror. And Leonard, you'll remember the name of that that movie.
Lady in the Lake.
Lady in the Lake, Robert Montgomery.
Yep.
And he's only seen in reflections. I said, that's what we'll do with Dorothy. We'll see the shoes. We'll see the ruby slippers. We'll see all the characters around. We just won't see her. It'll be great. And the whole room dropped 40 degrees.
Oh, God.
Boom. And they all looked at each other and said, I don't know about that. And the next call I got was from my agent saying, they're looking to settle the deal with you here.
Note to self, when trying to get out of something, just give them the most ridiculous idea and see how it goes.
Yes.
I guess so. Everybody thought I had committed career suicide by doing that. You know, it was like my smart aleck move with Richard Pryor.
Sure.
One of those things that going to get you killed eventually.
Yeah.
But your father was right, though.
Yes, he was. Well, he was an Air Force general. He understood about managing people.
I just want to talk for a second because about Dracula, because you worked with Frank Langella and Laurence Olivier and Donald Pleasance.
Yeah.
What was that like? And Laurence Olivier, did you have the reaction that I would think most of us would have when you were in a room with him? How did you figure out how to direct him?
Oh, I was so intimidated.
Yeah.
I would keep saying, being a good Southern boy from Alabama, I was already well trained to say people, call people sir.
Right.
So, yes, sir. When we would have a conversation, yes, sir. And he'd say, Larry, dear boy, Larry. I say, yes, sir, Larry, sir. I finally had to say to him, you don't understand. When I was 5 years old in England in the middle of World War II, the first movie that my mother ever took me to see was Henry V, directed by you, starring you. And now it's hard for me to call you Larry. It's really tough.
Yeah.
But he couldn't have been better. I've found that most directors, if you get them acting in your film, they're so glad that they're not having to do all the decisions
and, sure.
and be the director. I can just be here to say my lines and go home. And of course, he was a great support for everybody because the entire crew and all the cast respected him so much that even though he was very ill and had recovered from a very serious cancer, you know, everybody was there to support him long, and we're glad to have him, and he had a wicked sense of humor. so it wasn't just like we had some old sick person on set. We had somebody who was happy to be entertaining us every day with stories of, you know, encounters with John Lennon and, you know, different things when he was running the National Theater.
Wow, what an experience.
Yes. And then put Langella with him.
Yeah.
Who like Olivier is one of the most athletic actors of his generation, physically athletic. And these two going together with very strong personalities. Wow. Phew. That was every day was quite exciting for me.
I'm sure. How do you find your place? How for you personally, how do you find your place when you're dealing with people like that who are so much themselves? I mean, you know, it's one thing to work with someone who maybe isn't established, you know, where they may be more willing. But how do you figure out how to direct legends?
Well, Elia Kazan used to say that he would spend as much time as he could with them, with his actors before they started shooting, not necessarily rehearsing, but just spending time, going to dinner with them, going out, just spending a little bit of time with with James Dean or Eli Wallach or whoever Kazan was directing, and learning things about their personality and their character, all the while that you may be talking about the character and what the character does, and forming a bond with them so that it's not just a employer-employee relationship or dictator, slave type, but one where they realize that they can trust you, that you understand the kind of character they're going for, and are there to be helpful to them, because all of these actors like to be directed. They don't want you just to sit back and you say, "Oh, that was wonderful. Let's go to the next shot." They want some feedback. They want to hear from you. And of course they don't want, as Leonard said earlier, they don't want to be smoked.
Mm-hmm.
They don't want to, they want to hear something that makes sense in it. So that is the pressure. You're trying to be sensible and smart in what you're saying, but it being supportive,
right,
of what they're trying to do at the same time.
You're a big believer in rehearsal. And some people see that word and think, well, you're learning your lines, you're doing the blocking, but rehearsal can mean a lot more.
Rehearsal means finding, for the actor, it means finding the character, finding what the world is that they're going into. They could learn the lines and come in the first day and start shooting, but they would be lacking the foundation and the background. And so if you're able to have, in a movie, let's say, if you're able to have a week of rehearsal, you can learn a lot, and the character can be comfortable, so your first day of shooting is not just kind of guesswork of, oh, which way is the wind blowing? But Sidney Lumet always believed in having 4 weeks of rehearsal for his movies, and the actors would come in so totally adjusted now to their characters and prepared, so that Lumet's movies only were shot in like less than 30 days, whereas normal directors would be taking 50 days, but because he prepped them so carefully. Coming out of the theater, where you believe in rehearsal and letting the actors find their characters and giving them time, because it's not just like turning on a machine. Rod Steiger said to me, I just hate it when the director turns to me and says, "The magic, please." And I've sat there and waited for 2.5 hours while the cameraman was lighting it, and they're putting these stupid microphones on me, and they're adjusting my makeup and all of this. And suddenly, "The magic, please," with no preparation and no rehearsal on my part. So yes, let's avoid that. Let's get it. Let's give them some preparation, and we're going to get a richer, more character, more in depth, and not just the same old character they've been playing for years.
How have you dealt with failure? Because you've had enormous success, and like everybody, you've had some flops.
Sure.
It's not yet a punishable crime under the current statutes, but you have to be able to recalibrate. You have to be able to somehow bounce back. How do you deal with it?
Well, what was it? Do you remember what Adlai Stevenson said when he was defeated for the presidency?
Yeah, it hurts too much.
It hurts too much to laugh, but I'm big enough not to cry.
Or, yeah, something like that. Yeah,
something like along those lines. Of course, it hurts when something you've worked on for a long time, for a year or 2 years, and it doesn't hit, either because you did it badly or it wasn't marketed well or whatever the reason. And you have to say, well, I'm going to lay down and die here, or I'm going to get up and try again. And I, that's the only solution I knew, because I couldn't, I wasn't going to walk away from it. I enjoy making the films too much and try to learn from the experience and say, where did I go wrong? What can I do to do better here? Was it my choice of the script, or I didn't do the service to the script that I should have done? Or I didn't get whatever could the reason was, but said definitely not to pick up your toys and go home.
Yeah. And you're living proof that that can happen, because you're still plying your trade and passing along your vast amount of experience to a new generation.
Well, hopefully so. I mean, I have great fun working with new young filmmakers, mm-hmm. and seeing their perspective on things and trying to convey a little bit of knowledge, but also to learn from them.
Right. Do you have a film in your roster that you are fond of but didn't succeed at the box office? Is there like an orphaned movie that you still have deep affection for?
Well, my film of Whose Life Is It Anyway,
mm-hmm.
Is one that I dearly love and worked very hard on, worked very hard to get the film in the first place, adapted from the English play, and working with Richard Dreyfuss and Christine Lottie and John Cassavetes was exciting, but also dealing with a very difficult material about a person's right to choose the way they're going to go. If they're going to pass away, if they're sick, do they have any control over that? Or are we just going to go with everybody else's demands that we stay alive no matter how miserable we are?
Mm-hmm.
So much the right to die, but the right to choose.
Right, right. I imagine John Cassavetes kept you on your toes.
Oh, he was so much fun. He just made me laugh all the time, because he was so perpetually grouchy that you had to laugh. He turns to me one day, he said, "Kid," this is when you could call me kid. He said, "I'm doing things for you I wouldn't do for myself." And so he was always great fun, but you know, when you roll that camera, you're getting a powerful performance
mm-hmm.
from him and a great sense of improvisation, you know, which I thought was always wonderful. Never knew quite what you were going to get from him.
Must be quite an experience. I can't imagine not just being with him on a shoot, but directing him.
Yeah.
First day he came on the set, he has a scene where they call him on the telephone in the hospital, and they say Richard Dreyfuss, his character, is acting up and causing all these nurses terrible problems. And so the character's line is, "Give Mr. Harrison 10 milligrams of Valium, stat." And John Cassavetes comes to me and he said, "This is the dumbest line ever." I said, "What's the matter with it?" At least I knew to ask that. What's the matter? He said, "Well, it just sounds so formal. Give Mr. Harrison 10 milligrams of Valium, stat. I mean, I would never say that." I said, "What would you say, John?" He said, "I'd say, give that bastard a shot." I explained to him, I said, "John, these are doctors that have to be exact.
Yeah.
You can't just leave it to some nurse to decide what's the right dosage. You know, this guy would be thrown out of the hospital if he did did that, whereas we're playing a character who's the head of the hospital. So, okay, all right, all right.
That made sense to him. He
got it.
He allowed it. Yeah.
Yeah, he allowed it. Too much fun.
Yeah.
Well, you've provided a lot of entertainment for a long time. And again, I tip my hat to you, John, for sharing your stories so freely and so candidly. Mm-hmm. And also in your book, and I'm sure in your audiobook too, you have wonderful quotes from people like Oliver Stone and John Frankenheimer and other directors about their experiences, comparing yours and theirs. So it really is almost a symposium.
Well, it is. I think I called it a cyber session.
Mm-hmm.
With all of these people. Mm-hmm. and getting their insights, not just mine, but I learned so much from talking to Steven Soderbergh or Oliver Stone.
Mm-hmm.
You know, really, really great directors.
And they're as candid as you.
Mm.
And
that
makes it a great experience. Again, the name of the book, which has been in print for a long time, is called I'll Be in My Trailer: The Creative Wars Between Directors and Actors, by John Badham with Craig Moderno. And it is now available in various formats, including a new audiobook. And we thank you for your time.
And your stories.
And your stories.
Well, thank you. It's so much fun to talk to both of you.
There is truly nothing like experience. And that's why I say students really are so lucky to have someone who's willing to talk turkey, but also still has a really positive outlook.
Yeah.
He enjoys this. He likes doing this.
Yes.
And he wants other people who do it to feel the same.
Yep.
And he wants them to feel like they're empowered and they have the knowledge. And that is something that, anyone can learn. Anyone can learn that it's important to know how to speak to people and how to make them feel, again, respected and heard,
mm-hmm.
even if you don't really feel like that. You just,
yes.
You know, it's a lesson just in life.
Well, it's been said many times that the director's part babysitter,
yes.
part psychologist,
yes, yes, yes,
part
yes.
bartender,
yep.
You know, he or she fulfills many functions.
Yeah.
Boy. It's a little overwhelming, actually.
Yeah.
Talking to a guy like that who's done so much.
Yeah.
And he's had hits and he's had flops.
Yeah. Well, even that,
but he's kept going.
To be able to discuss both.
Yeah.
You know, and to understand that both happen, and sometimes they're your fault, and sometimes they are not.
Yep.
You know, we've all had movies that we don't understand why they weren't more successful. You see something and you go, why isn't this a bigger hit?
And again, it must be said and re-said, no one sets out to make a bad movie.
Never, ever, ever.
And yet it happens.
Never, ever. I always think about that, you know, when they have the first cast screening, when they have the first cast and crew screening, you know, when you're, whatever your part is in a film or a TV show, you're just doing your part. When you sit down to watch it and it's all put together, you really don't know what it's gonna look like or sound like.
Mm-hmm. Nope.
So as an actor, you can feel really good and then they put it all together and you go, huh. As a director, you put all the pieces together and maybe the studio had more input than you wish they would and they make choices. It's just, this is why I say that movies are miracles, because the amount of work that goes into every single piece. And no one knows until it's finished what it's going to be.
Yep.
Really.
Ta-da!
Ta-da, yeah, no
yeah,
kidding.
Here it is, right.
Man, oh man.
Okay.
Very, very, as always, very grateful. Grateful to him as a guest and grateful to you guys for listening. We appreciate it. If you are looking to find us on the socials, I am at Jesse Malton. You are at Leonard Malton on Twitter and Instagram. You're also on Facebook. We have a YouTube channel, which is Malton on Movies, and we have leonardmalton.com for movie reviews, book roundups, and all kinds of good stuff.
Exactly so. And we have Patreon.
The Maltreon.
If you like what we do, if you enjoy what we do here and on our Sunday live streams and online, and you want to pitch in and help us keep doing it, you can do so by going to patreon.com/maltononmovies. Mm-hmm. And we have different ways of thanking you.
Mm-hmm.
And we do thank you. And we thank you all for listening. See you next week.